Well, I almost did it. Good morning, everyone. Happy Sabbath to you all. It is actually great to be back home. It was a long week down in Cincinnati, but it is good back being your own home, home bed, own food. Okay, just trying to get things going here. Light, please. Somebody. Yeah, there we go. Okay, we're going to pick up where we left off last time. I think we're at week 69 of the 70 weeks prophecy sermon. We got one more part that we will cover. Notice I don't have my light up here, so I'm going to be struggling a little bit to do this today. I might need something on. But before we get started in this sermon and covering that second part of verse 27 that we've been going through, I want to address a question that seems to be still in the air of why. Why are we taking so much time and so much detail of such a prophecy that seems to could just be given in one sermon? So if you would please, turn over to Matthew 24. Matthew 24, and we're going to just skim through this. You know, it's kind of interesting. I appreciate Mark, Mr. Miller, with that sermonette, because it's something that's important that we always keep in mind. The Bible identifies truth. No matter what anyone says, no matter what anyone tries to put forth, we know what the Word, the documented Word that God breathed, is important for, and it teaches us. It gives us what we need to defend against everything that would go against what God calls truth, what He identifies as truth, what He reveals as His truth. And in Matthew 24, verse 1, we see this interesting. We covered this before. This is very familiar. The disciples are coming to Christ and saying, "Hey, what's going on? Tell us this. You've been preaching all this time about this end time and things are going to take place. What is the sign of this? What is the sign of the end of time and when is your coming?" That works good. Thank you. I can actually read it and quit trying to quote it. They said on verse 3, tell us when these things will be, and what will be the sign of your coming in the end of the age. And the first thing Christ said is, remember, what we've been covering so far is don't. Take heed. Don't let anyone deceive you. Don't take for granted the truth that's been revealed to you. Don't let someone try to twist these words. He's going to mention it 6 times through that whole conversation. There will be those seeking to disprove what I've spoken. They're going to be those just going to try to twist and disprove what you're going to write, what you're going to record throughout history. But you have to stay strong. Know this word. Do not be deceived. He goes, there's going to be so many people that are going to say, "I'm the Christ. Then this is the way. Follow me." But you got to know. And he says, and during this time, people will hate one another. The law of which my word, the law of which my life, but I laid down that example for you that made things all possible for you, they will walk away from. And the love they had for this truth, the love they had for this way, it will grow cold. It won't change them for the good. They will start turning against one another. He mentions that in verse 10. And he says in verse 15, therefore, you want a sign? You want something to be right in your face that can be proven through history, that can be proven from what I'm talking about? He says, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, Mark is saying, whoever reads these words, remember, take heed, mark what our Lord and Savior said. Whoever reads, let them understand. That's why we keep going back. That's why we've taken our time. Because we're no different than those disciples sitting before Jesus asking that question. We ask that question because we here too are saying, dear Lord, how long? What's going on? This world is crazy. We've been living this for so long. We've been believing it. And the world is turning against you. The world is turning against us. And just like the disciples that day, if we go about it ourselves, our eyes will not be able to see. Our ears won't be able to hear. Our heart won't be able to discern without them being open, without them taking the time to know, to invest, to grow in this way of life by putting this word to use. We don't just just believe this. We have to be obedient to these words. Again, you've heard me say it over and over. We're not called to put Christ in our lives. We're called to let Christ live His life in us. Christ is our life. We don't want to be deceived and lose life. There will be someone offering a life, but it won't be life. It'll be death. That's why Jesus put a lot of emphasis on deception. He said, if you're not a people committed, if you're not a people who desire to know their God, a people who want, who see the value of this relationship so much, they covenanted with their God. They covenanted with me. They commit their life to me. It's not just something they do. It's something they become. If you're not a people like that who want the attributes of holiness, you will fall for anything in this end time. Why says, who reads? Let them understand. Because if you don't hold on to the attributes of God's holiness, if you don't seek to place yourself under that authority, that deception that will get you in the end time will start in your own heart and mind with self-deception. If you deceive yourself and thinking you're okay, if you deceive yourself and think you can figure it out yourself, when it really comes forward, when the end time, when these abominations and all this stuff starts to happen, yeah, like Mr. Shaby, President Shaby mentioned, it might be easy to spot the cockroaches' eggs. But what will be put forth for the very elect? It can fall for. You can easily fall for if you're not careful. That's why we have to know our God. That's why this relationship, if we want to know, just like the disciples, we come to the feet of our Christ. We come to the feet of Jesus and say, help. Help me know how you want to be worshipped. How you are teaching us to come before our Father's throne. That's the throne we look for. That's the throne we yearn for. That's the city that we want to be part of. Not what man offers, but what you're offering. So it's very important that we understand what we're to look forward and look out for. That's why this prophecy is that vital for us who in the end of the age have fallen. And with that, if you want to turn back to Daniel. And we're going to go a long way in this prophecy today by reading one sentence. One sentence. Because that one sentence is very vital to what we just heard. What we just heard in Matthew. But let's just go ahead and read just the full verse in Daniel 9, 27. It says, Daniel 9, verse 27 says, then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. Now, we already covered that. Christ is saying, you got to know what's going on. There's two spirits at work in this end time. There's going to be two sacrificial systems that are going to be presented as the way, the truth, and the life. And only one has the power and the authority. Only one links its way back to what a covenant by God takes place. Those words, remember, we covered, links us back to Genesis 15, cutting of the flesh, only one sacrifice. One sacrifice of the cutting of flesh is worthy to covenant with. But then here's this change. And who are we talking about here? He says, and on the wing of abomination shall be one who makes desolate, even unto the consummation which is determined is poured out on the desolate. In fact, we're not even going to have enough time to get through that whole sentence today. What's been identified here? It's something very important, exactly what Christ just said. A very important sign of the end of the age. Something that's tied to this deception. Something that's tied to changing the focus to a people, even he said later, would even capture the very elect if they're not careful. It says, and on the wing of abomination shall be one who makes desolate. It's in this second part of verse 27 we find that important dual prophecy that Christ says is important. And that's what we're going to cover today. I want to cover that first fulfillment. That first fulfillment, so as we heard, Mark said that manuscripts, things have been in history. It's not just biblical history. We find this heavily documented in just world history. But we're also, as Christ said, we look forward too. We don't just look back to remember. We look forward to what's going to take place, because that second fulfillment is still yet to come, and it's very important. But let's talk about first this first fulfillment, very first fulfillment, because it's an important thing, because prophecy reveals what God has done. What He has done, what is He going to continue to do? As you well-known students of the Bible, you know, back in Daniel, his whole letter, his whole manuscript, starting very early on, but back in Daniel 5 through chapter 5 through 8, and then in chapter, we'll see it and cover it later in verse 11, we see this foundation that Daniel was told through Gabriel, some of the dreams sent to Nebuchadnezzar. There's a foundation being laid. He said, I'm setting a stage of how this dual prophecy is going to change the world. It's going to be a very important aspect of how you have a worldview, have a biblical worldview. No, I am the God who's in charge. And I want you to see these things. Again, we won't be able to cover every single detail, but you know these things. And if you don't, go back and study them. But what we're going to do is just hit the highlights. Highlights in order to show the providence of God's master plan. The providence of God revealing His prophecy. And we will definitely see these two spirits, these two sacrificial systems. One that is of the kingdom of heaven, and one that's of the kingdom of Babylon, which we know are two kingdoms at war. If you would, turn back to Daniel 8. Some of this, you'll know, comes well before the prophecy came of recovering the 70 weeks. Daniel 8 captures a lot of this, what we talked about, this the setting up of the stage of what's going on. Daniel 8, we see something very important here. We see in verse 3. It says, and I lifted up. Well, let's just, in way of context, let's just pick it up in verse 1. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after the one that appeared to me the first time. And I saw in the vision, and it so happened while I was looking, that I was in Shushan, the citadel, and which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in the vision that I was by the river Euphrates. And then I lifted up my eyes and saw, and there, standing beside the river, was a ram which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. He's describing something that's really starting an empire that's coming together to be something powerful, something that would come after that golden head, that very one we know he's been a part of in the Babylonian system. In verse 4, and I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward, so that no beast could withstand him. This is a power that's coming against one of the most powerful ruling empires so far in the world, but yet he's still pushing forward. And again, nothing could stop what he's doing, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand. But he did according to his will, and he became great. That's a very important marker. And if you want to, you can turn back to go forward in verse 20 in chapter 8. In verse 20, he identifies something. He's still continuing in this description of this ram. He said, this mighty thing that was taking place that no one could withstand, which you saw who was had those two horns, these are the kings of the Medes and the Persians. Media and Persia. A great empire. Again, two kingdoms that would become as one, so powerful, and he would push forward all over. No one could stop them. As we know, this was done under King Cyrus. King Cyrus of the Medo-Persian Empire. In fact, we know this is taking place. Daniel is actually seeing this in Daniel 9. That's why he went to God and said, hey, what's going on? Something major is happening. In fact, I know you gave a prophecy 150 years ago to Isaiah saying that this servant of yours would come and pay back this Babylonian way. The golden head would be crushed and took down. Now he's seeing this happen. And we know in history this happened in 539 BC. However, that's not the end. I hit the slide a little too fast there, but it's okay. Go back to verse 5. Verse 5. He says that he's even considering this great thing, this empire, that this goat that was doing all this damage, something else happened. He goes, and I was considering suddenly a male goat came from the west across the surface of the whole earth. Without touching the ground, he said, I thought that other image was doing damage. This one just look going so fast, he looks like he's hovering. His feet are not even touching the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Then he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and he ran at him with furious power. He's not even scared of this power, a power that just dominated Babylon. He is just running at him with his full furious power. And I saw him confronting this ram. He was moved with rage. He is not just somebody out there at war. There's something about this individual. He has got this anger. There's this fury and there's this rage, his conquering rage. And he had it against him and he attacked the ram and he broke his two horns. And there was no power in this ram. That all once powerful ram that did so much damage, this goat just utterly made useless, helpless. He said he cast him down to the ground. He trampled upon him, and there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. Therefore, this male goat grew very strong. We know in history this did take place. In fact, if you want to turn forward to verse 21, Daniel's getting told this, and Gabriel is telling him, this is what's happening, and this is still going to happen, Daniel. You're witnessing things, but there's going to be even more after you. He goes, yes, you saw what Babylon did. You saw God pay them back. You've seen Medes and the Persians come in, but he says, this male goat, verse 21, this male goat is the kingdom of Greece. Yes, there will be another empire, as you saw in the statue. It was given earlier on. This kingdom of Greece, yeah, that large horn that is between its eyes is that first king. He's very important. You got to look at him. I'm just trying to find myself my notes. Okay. Got to get this light here because I got a little shadow. Excuse me. That very important individual we know in history came out of Greece is Alexander the Great. Alexander was a very powerful man. In fact, you remember his father, Philip. Philip was a very powerful. And then when Alexander thought, well, Dad's conquering everything, he's not going to leave anything for me. And he cried. But then it was his turn to take his throne. This individual had such great ambition and power. He just destroyed everything and anything in his path. However, as we go back, if you turn back to Daniel 8, pick it up in verse 8 again. Daniel 8, 8. Then that male goat grew very great, but when he had became strong, the large horn, which grew exceedingly great towards the south. Wait, excuse me, I went to verse 9. But when he became strong, the large horn, which was broken, and in its place four notable ones came up towards the four winds of heaven. When this powerful ram came and did what he did, he conquered this ram, I mean the goat with two horns, this powerful empire. Yet in that time, it didn't last. Even his horn was broken. And as we know in history, this individual, Alexander the Great, at his prime, yes, he had a horrible lifestyle. I'm not even going to get into that. But in his prime, at the height of his power in 323 BC, at the age of only 32, at the age of 32, he died. He died just as Daniel was told would take place. And these four horns now need to come forth. And before his death, he had a lot of generals that were taking care of all these provinces across the land. So he divided them up, and these generals started to take place. At first, it wasn't just four. There was a multiple different people taking over different areas. But the four top generals that really started to be notable were that of Ptolemy, Seleucus, Cassander, and at first, Antagonist. But he only reigned for a short period. Lysimachus is the one who's really known as that top four general. So you had these four generals, Ptolemy, Seleucus, Cassander, and Lysimachus. They're this great power, and there's this great power struggle. Let's pick it up in verse 9. Keep reading verse 9. And he says, "And out of them came a little horn which grew exceedingly towards the north, south, towards the east, and towards a glorious land. And it grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the hosts and some of the stars to the ground, and he trampled them." So what we're being described here is these four generals were not just happy. They weren't happy to be in control of those little provinces. There's something about these two. They go at war. There's this great power struggle that's coming out, and history records that these four generals went at each other very viciously, murdering and being deceitful. Until two of these generals rose to be the two great powers, one of the Ptolemaic Empire, that of Seleucid Empire, taking control of everything that you see here. And they being later referred to as the King of the North and the King of the South, that Seleucid Empire and the Ptolemaic Empire. That King of the North was Assyria, the Near Eastern territories. The King of the South, the Ptolemaic Empire, became that of Egypt. Were they happy? No, we just read something about these. Something's going to grow out from one of these and stir this power. The struggles between these were recorded in history as some horrific battles. These two kingdoms fought between each other, and guess what was caught right in between them? The Holy Land. The Holy Land. Again, can you see God setting up the stage? Setting up the stage of that first fulfillment of this prophecy, letting us see what will happen in the end time. All that which will be at war in the end time will be focused around one thing. Jerusalem. Of the Holy Land. People will fight. In fact, you can read on your own, see how this first part in Daniel 11, the first part of Daniel 11, actually speaks about all these things that will take place. And in Daniel 11, we find a lot of explanation of what Daniel wrote in Daniel 9 about that wing. "Upon a wing of abomination shall be one that makes desolate." In fact, Daniel 11 explains exactly what Jesus was talking about in Matthew 24. You got to watch. You got to know how these things unfolded because they're going to do it again. I gave Daniel these dreams. I sent these things to be recorded for a purpose. Don't be deceived. And again, history confirms it. I already went to the slide on accident. But out of that small horn, that Seleucid Empire, that northern kingdom, came a prince of a people. And this prince of a people would become this powerful, powerful king. He would push. He wasn't satisfied with what he had. He would push southern and do everything in his hopes to take over that southern kingdom. But he fails. As you can continue to read on your own. He will fail. And he was stopped by that Ptolemaic army. And out of his anger, he will turn back north and enter that Holy Land. And not only he's of rage and he's of hate. As you can read it, it describes that leader that would come. He did a great abominations. He wasn't just happy to conquer. He wanted to be an abomination to the people. He wanted to be an abomination to their land. He wanted to be an abomination to their ways of life and their temple. And in fact, you know this. It's recorded in history. This took place. It seared into the hearts and minds of every Jewish person to this very day. Somewhere around 168 BC, that first fulfillment that Daniel was told by Gabriel of this dual prophecy would take place. This little blasphemous horn named Antiochus Epiphanes. After he was turned back, when he went down in the armies of Egypt, turned him back, he was very angry. History records how angry he was. So much he set himself with all his armies. He goes, I will put myself on a path of utter destruction. Saying, I will not just destroy everything in my path. I'm going to defile everything in this path. And when he came to Jerusalem, he entered that temple. He erected a statue of Zeus. And he offered swine on the holy altar. Pretty in your face. You know, we often hear a lot about this man's impact in the history. We hear about that attack on the Holy Land. However, it's also interesting to know when you study who this man actually was. In fact, his name, of what he tried to represent himself as, actually reveals a lot what we have to be aware of. In fact, his name was not Antiochus Epiphanes when he came to rule. His name was Mithridates. And I know I said that wrong, but I got it written down here phonetically. Let me see if I find it here. Yes, Mithridates. I guess I was kind of close. But that was his given name. But when he rose to power, he chose a special name. One, the first name being a title, and then Epiphanes being a description. Antiochus is Greek. Antiochus is Greek, and it means to come against, to be compared to be like. Epiphanes comes from the Greek as well. Epiphanes is a title of a deity that meant God manifest, glorious, illustrious, or bright and shining experience. Is the gears starting to turn in your head to what we're supposed to be looking forward, look out for? You think of this name. When you put it all together, Antiochus Epiphanes simply meant, I am compared to, I am like the glorious one. I am God manifest. And he set himself up in that temple to be the great, illustrious God manifest of that time. He wanted to be worshipped. He commanded all to be worshipped or be put to death. He saw himself as a god. He wanted to be treated like a god. And what history reveals about this time is just sad, because some fell for this in the land of Israel. Some were taken over by this ruler. Some even offered sacrifices. They accepted it with him. They saw him as this bright and shiny, illustrious one, an appearance, an epiphania of a deity. However, thankfully, there were those who refused. There were those who stood for the holy things of God. They were those, as we saw in Daniel 11:32, they did not corrupt their covenant. They didn't get caught up in the flatteries of the time. They were those who knew their God, and they were able to stand and do great exploits. That's why I keep repeating that. Please, I beg you. Make that verse one of your memory verses. Daniel 11:32. It's vital. It's vital. We're going to be talking about it some more as we go through here. Because it was those who knew their God, that didn't get caught up and became corrupted. Those who knew their God and was able to do great exploits that eventually led to that Maccabean revolt. Again, that's outlining history, biblical history. Josephus records a bunch of this stuff. And it's all, if you look at the biblical outline, the historical outline, timelines, you see it just lines up perfect. There's no manipulation. Because what God said would come about did come about. It did take place. And just as it has taken place in our history, Christ said, it's going to happen again. I want you to be familiar with this. Understand it. Read it. Because it's going to be in your face. Just like the disciples said, what will be the sign of your coming and this kingdom that you're going to set up? So we have to understand this is just as important for us to look forward to. Because unlike Antiochus Epiphanes, who just came with force, who just came with power, this next one who will come upon the wings of that which will make desolate and cause abominations to take place, he will come with even a greater force. He's going to come with even greater power. He's going to come with lying wonders. In fact, he's mentioned in Daniel 12, Matthew 24, 15. And if you want to turn here, 2 Thessalonians. Let's turn. Let's go ahead and turn there. 2 Thessalonians. Chapter 2. Second Thessalonians 2. Let's just pick it up in verse 3. Again, you hear these echoed from Christ. Let no one deceive you by any means. Just like Mark mentioned in his sermonette. They're going to just people say, Christ. What Christ? He died. There's no resurrection. It's just all futile. We wouldn't be warned about this if it wasn't going to take place. If it wouldn't be an attempt against us. Let no one deceive you by any means. For that day will not come unless the falling away comes first. And the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes, who exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped. He's going to just try and say, you know, that thing that happened, that wasn't the authority. I am that. I'm compared to. I'm the grand, illustrious one, the glorious one. It's me. You're my people. Look at me. He's going to do this again. Who opposes this? And that is called God and that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Are we going to even have place in our heart, those who are God's temple? Will we be those who are going to corrupt our covenant and we're going to look to him as God of our life? It says, be careful about this. He's going to try these things. Do you not remember that when I was still with you, I told you these things? They're that important. I wasted breath for you. I could have been doing something else, but I warned you. I told you this is important for your life. Paul died for these words to be given. And now you know what is restraining, that he may be revealed in his own time. Verse 9, the coming of this lawless one is according to the working of Satan. That Babylonian system is still there. It might have had different names all these years and all these kingdoms. It's still there. It's still present. According to that work of Satan, with all power, with all signs, with lying wonders, and with all unrighteous deception among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. Those who did not know their God will fall for this. Those who allowed the flatteries to capture them. Those who wanted to look like a Jewish person. Those who wanted to use these special names. Those who wanted a system that made them feel good. Instead of those who knew their God and carried out the exploits that he commanded to stand firm. Paul was revealing something very important here. Something that many scholars have stated concerning that statement about the one who will make desolate. That Daniel referred to in his verse in 9:27. Actually, when they cover this section, they translate what Daniel said as that which causes appallment. It's not just a person. It's just not something near the temple. They're saying it's a system. It's a powerful system, and it's going to be rooted in one of the most powerful systems of all. That which is ruled of Satan himself. That which we know in the church is the Babylonian way of life. In fact, in Revelation 13, you can go ahead and turn there. We're going to be there in a few minutes. In Revelation 13, we read about the source of this power. We actually are being told the effect of this power. Those who do not depart, those who are not willing to remove themselves, come out of her, my people. Those who think that they can approach God the way they want. John is told, the same angel that talked to Daniel is telling John, write these again. I want you to show these my people this second fulfillment, because it will happen, and it's going to affect mankind. It's going to affect them in a way that they've never seen in their lives. And then John, in fact, describes these just like Daniel in a little bit more detail. So let's go ahead, and if you would, if you're already there, it's Revelation 13. I guess I need to be there. Revelation 13, and we see these two beasts that are described here, and we'll see how they have their authority and this system they've come to promote. And we'll see the same characteristics that Daniel was dealing with. We'll see how, just like the old epiphania of Jesus came to a temple, another epiphania will appear in this temple. Revelation 13. Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having 7 heads, 10 horns, and out of his horns, 10 crowns, and on his head a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear. His mouth was like the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. Then you keep going about how they worshipped him. He did all these things. Nothing seemed to be able to stop him. Then he opened verse 5. And he was given a mouth, saying these great things, blasphemous things. And he was given authority to continue for 42 months. Then he opened his mouth and blasphemous things against God, to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and all those who dwell in the heavens. He's not afraid of anything. He feels that power. He feels that grand and lustrous of himself. He's been given this by another being that he don't care about God. He sees himself as God compared to, who's going to stop me? And it was granted to him to make war, even with the saints. I want those. I want to deceive those. I got everybody else, these cockatrices' eggs, as we read in Isaiah. But I want these. These who call themselves the elect of God. And he, unfortunately, as we know, will succeed. He will make war. He will be given the authority. And he will try to overcome them. This first beast, again, just like that of the first fulfillment, is very powerful. Verse 1 identifies that he will come out of the sea. He will come out of humanity, out of the nations. He will be a political leader, a very powerful political leader. He is described as an individual, again, being of a world-renowned power. He gains all kinds of power. You can see a leader today gains it in military function. He gains it with economics. He gains it as a throne, known like a head of the state, a head of the world. And again, we know that Satan is the one who gives him this power. You don't have to turn there, but In Revelation 17, 13, we find that this beast power will not need to actually invade every country. It's because of that power he holds, that reputation that goes before him. He has this great influence. He possesses this way, this power, and he will gain dominance and admiration. He will gain this great respect. And Gabriel reveals that this rise of favor on this world scene will be all because of this dragon, that Satan will give him what he needs. Again, this beast, in Revelation, I think it's in Revelation 17, 13, that section, this beast is held in such admiration. He's held with such reverence that when this system does fall, as it says in 13:5, that the world will be crushed. They're going to like, oh, not our God die. How can we fall for this? Well, Gabriel tells us how we can fall for it. In fact, look at verse 2. Look how he describes them. Look how he described this power that's going to come on the scene, that's going to be gaining all this reverence. He starts out by calling him a leopard. You've watched leopards on nature shows. Leopards are known for their ability to be stealth. They're right in plain sight, perfectly camouflaged. The victim is already dead before they know it. They can't outrun it. It's already sitting right beside them. The victim never knew they were in danger. However, just the ability to be stealth and charismatic, not just charismatic, but powerful and influential, is only scratching the surface of this powerful beast. He's also described as that bear, those feet. Powerful, hard to kill. And just like that lion, he says, they're known for their destructive roars, their strength. I mean, I could imagine being on the savannah in Africa and I hear a roar and I'm like, I'm not moving. He may not be seen, but I know that power. And I am not going to fight against that power. That's what this being is going to be like. He will announce himself. He will have such esteem and power, he won't even have to fight. And people will yield themselves to it. It's a great display of overwhelming power. And it will happen so fast. It will happen with such great power. And it will be so effective that he really won't even have to attack anything. Again, there will be wars. But when you put together this perfect war machine, he will dominate. He will dominate as God says. Now consider this as a whole. Consider this great power, this first beast on a whole. And think about what Daniel, I showed the pictures earlier. Think about all those beasts that Daniel described as leading up to this. Each beast overtook, and they didn't just destroy, they assimilated, came bigger, assimilated, came bigger. And what was the name of that final beast? Great and dreadful. So much so, it seems like no one could stand against him. He is the best of the worst. And so when you think about all these attributes that this power will have, you think about everything that he holds, he don't have to just demand it. It's going to be his way or death. Those who don't know their God and trust their God and know what the plan of salvation is may succumb to this. But what about the next beast? Verse 11, then I saw another beast coming out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. And he exercised all the authority of the first beast in his presence. And he caused the earth and all those in it to worship this first beast whose deadly wounds were healed. Again, he performs great signs so that he even makes the fire come down from heaven on earth in the sight of men. That should make us stop and think. This individual is going to be trying to act just like God's two witnesses. He's going to try to deceive us and make us think, I can do what God does. I mean, make sure you all think about Egypt. When Moses came against Pharaoh, and Pharaoh said, oh, look, my men can do this. They can call snakes to come forth. They can change these things. Your God's nothing. Satan is still working the same way. He deceives those who dwell on the earth, verse 14, by the signs which he was granted to be done in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image of the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. A powerful system that seemed to be killed over years ago, but now it's rising. It's dominant of this earth. He says, this is no other power could do this other than what a God would do. So he's trying to point everybody, not just to the beast, but to this system. And President Shabby mentioned that we could see how this development AI can go forward in seeing this verse 15 about making this image, and that image starts to speak as just like that beast, so that even the very elect can fall. He will come out of this earth. He will be like people. He will be very charismatic. He'll be called that false prophet, this spiritual leader. And again, he will have these same powers as first beast. He will be filled with lying wonders. He'll be able to do even miracles, trying to pull our attention away from the true God. That's why this, know your God. Know who the door, know the way, the truth, the life, the shepherd who stands and said, I know my sheep, and my sheep hear my voice. Can we hear the shepherd's voice? Or have we decided to make our own voice? That's why it's so important that we stay on guard. Again, this individual is the perfect sheep in wolves. Strike that, rewind like Willy Wonka. He's the perfect wolf in sheep's clothing. He's very charismatic. He may look the part. He may speak some very good words, but as we told, are those words of truth? They may be hard to swallow, but God loves us enough to tell us the truth and correct us. Or are those words like butter? Are they oil? Do they just make me feel good? Or are they teaching me how to fight the spiritual warfare that needs to be fought? How to overcome? How to walk a different way of life? How to transform, not conform? What is being told here? Is he trying to make me feel like I'm good? Or is he trying to teach me how to be good? Like God says, these things you ought to do. Brethren, we see these things as in their infancy phase all over this world. We see them trying to infiltrate the church all the time. We see this effort of coexistence. All paths lead to God. Love is love. Just accept. But when we get to this point, if we haven't endured and put our feet upon that path and know our God, will we fall for such things? That's why we're being told, know it. Again, what Jesus in Matthew 24:15. What is our takeaway? These two individuals. That is not what I want to do. These two individuals will work a very powerful work in these end times. We will see something that will definitely be something to behold. It will capture our attention. But as we're told, it will be an abomination in the eyes of our God. It's an abomination that will not just lead the world in desolation. If we're not careful, it can lead us to desolation. We may not be those willing to blaspheme our God, but the way we yield ourselves to this power, we will blaspheme God. We will blaspheme. And just like that name, Antiochus Epiphanes, we saw back in 168 BC, this first beast, he will set himself up to be worshipped. This whole system will point us to worship him. When he appears on this scene, he too will be as God manifest. He will be glorious. He will be illustrious. He will have the words. He will be bright. He will be shining in that appearance. And he's going to stop at nothing to get into our hearts and minds. He's going to stop at nothing to get into this temple, the temple of the Most High God, the temple of which we're being built into. This is where knowing, this is where discerning, just like the disciples went to Christ, we have to go to Christ on our knees. What is your sign? What is your appearing going to be like? What are you teaching me? I have to discern what spirit I am yielding myself to. It's my lifeline. For those whom the ends of this age have fallen, if we don't know our God, if we don't know the true Jesus, if we're not willing to seek that way, that truth to life, if we're not willing to put our feet upon the path of holiness, will we know what's expected of us when the time comes? Will we know what God expects of us when it comes to worship in these end times? Will we be approaching the true throne of our Father? Or we allowed someone to lead us to a different throne? It's something we have to consider. It's something we have to keep in mind. Because we already see, as I mentioned, we already see the foundations of this being laid. And the way it's going to be presented, it's going to play into the desires of those who simply want to feel like and look like Jesus. These created false doctrines are going to be there to distract us. They're going to be there to distract us from what Jesus actually died for. The one who actually had the authority to end all sacrifices. The one who had the authority to do what was necessary for us to be part of that family. We don't want to just feed emotions. We want to feed this fire. We want to feed this altar. We want to be sweet savior to our Father. We want to be able to rise. Not be something that's an abomination in His eyes where He cast away from Him. We want to rise to Him. I say this because when we're going to see this power come on the scene, and it seems like it could be very soon in our lifetime, will we be the ones listening for the individual who claims to be Epiphania of Christ, or will we be those who cry out, "My God, can I hear your voice? My shepherd, speak so that I may hear." Again, this is a good place to stop. But we'll leave us a small portion, I promise, just one more sermon this series. But as you know me, we're not quite done yet. If you would please, to end today, I want to turn to Colossians. A couple sections of scriptures here. Colossians 3, because I feel like this actually wraps up and encapsulates what Daniel recorded for us, what John recorded for us, what Christ was willing to die for, why it was written down, and what's expected of us from whom the ends of the age have come. Colossians 3, verse 1. If you then were raised with Christ, if you have built this relationship that's so important, you're covenanted with, you're willing to put your life down and die. You're willing to live contrary to this world. You've seen it, you understood it, and you covenanted with it, and it's that valuable to you. Seek those things which are above. Not what the world says is good enough. What God reveals is great. What God reveals is holy. What God has said is worthy of my saints. Seek those things where Christ is. Not what someone tries to appear as Christ. You set your mind on Christ. He's not in your life. He is your life. Set your mind on the things above, not on the things of this earth. For you died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. So when Christ, who is your life, appears, when the true Epiphania, when Christ comes, that's where you will know. You will not be fooled by this false Epiphania of Christ. You will see the true Christ, because He will appear in His glory. As we know in 1 John 3, we will be like Him. Not just because we knew the secret code, but because we were willing to purify ourselves as He is pure. That's our goal. Not to feel good, but to endure what it takes. What it takes to do is important to Him. Final scripture, Malachi. Malachi 3. Pick it up in verse 16. David, you can go ahead and turn the light back on. I'm done with the slide. Malachi 3, verse 16. Then those who feared the Lord spoke to one another. Those who had a true reverence, those who knew their shepherd, those who knew their God were not ashamed. They assembled, they talked, they became what they proclaimed. One, a people who were willing to put forth the effort. Not assimilate, not conform, but be transformed. They talked about it. They spoke one to another. And the Lord listened, and He heard them because they knew their shepherd, and the shepherd knew them. And a book of remembrance was written before Him for those who feared the Lord and meditated on His name, esteemed His name. Not what made them feel good, but what was the true, authentic way of life. No one was entering their holy temple. No one was going to defile and make them abomination in front of the eyes of their God. No one would appear as God to them because they knew their God and they would not corrupt their covenant. They shall be mine, says the Lord of hosts, on the day that I make them my jewels. They're that precious to me. They came through the fire. They came through the pressure. So much so that I will display them on my head so that the world will see them. They will be like me. They will be my children for all eternity. They didn't fall for the temporary. They wanted what was eternal. So I will do as I promised. I will spare them as a man spares his own son who serves them. Verse 18. Then you shall again discern between the righteous and the wicked, between one who serves God and the one who does not serve God. Because when God is your life, when Christ is your life, your eyes will see, your ears will hear, your heart will be able to discern. For behold, the day is coming. It will happen. It's not what if. It is what will be. Burning like an oven, and all the proud, yes, all who do wickedly, will be stubble. Those who corrupt their covenant, they will have their time. And the day which shall come shall burn them up. But to you, verse 2, but to you who fear my name, the Son of Righteousness shall arise, because you set your mind on that which was above. You set your mind on that throne with all that authority. The Son of Righteousness shall arise with healing in His wings. Everything you had to endure, every hardship, your body riddled with pain, you may be corrupting in the grave. But God will heal you and give you something that epiphania, false epiphania, could never give you. Those who have that hope purifies themselves. You shall trample the wicked. No, it goes, not only that, with healing in His wings, and you shall go out and grow fat like a stall-fed calf. You won't have to worry. I will feed you. You will grow. You will have what you need. You shall trample the wicked, for they shall be ashes in the sole of your feet on the day that I do this, says the Lord of hosts. And I love this. Remember the law of Moses, my servant. It always goes back. Know me. Know me. I breathe this word of life for you. But it's up to you to know me, which I commanded him in Horeb for all Israel with the statutes and the judgments. If we're going to be a people who know their God, if we're going to be a people who are known by the true God in heaven, by the authentic Jesus Christ, it begins in how we approach them and this family this very day. We must be a people willing to set our mind on those things which are above, those things that God identifies as holy. We must be willing to sacrifice our entire heart, mind, and soul to be purified by what God identifies as holy. Not by our version, but by His version, so that we are not deceived, so that we are not caught off guard by this false epiphania of Christ that will come.